From ABC News, this is a special edition of Perspective 2021, America's Racial Reckoning, the second year. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, from Emmett Till to George Floyd, are we any closer to equality in the nation's legal system?
I think most of us believe that, hope that, but when I hear that quotation for Dr. King, I'm reminded of the word long. Justice sometimes takes a very long time.
From John Carlos to Colin Kaepernick, the role of sports in the discussion of social justice.
There's always been an obligation, and understanding that and then acting on it and being able to act on it again and again and again and again if need be, that's the difference between the luxury we have and previous generations who did not.
And what has changed, not just in the past year, but in the past 50 years?
The conversation that's happening in this country over the issue of race is a lot louder than it was then. The diversity of the media that is sharing these stories is different now than it was then.
All ahead on the special edition of Perspective, America's Racial Reckoning, the second year. George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis on May 25th, 2020. And in the 19 months since then, the nation has continued to ask questions about our history, our legacy, and ourselves. Let's begin last spring in Minneapolis with the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin. 10 months after the death of George Floyd on a Minneapolis street corner on Memorial Day weekend last year, the trial of the former police officer accused of killing him began. Before the first witness even took the stand, however, Black Americans were talking about this trial's significance. From Martin Luther King III,
this is a test for America, American justice, I believe. Because people are beyond fed up with a system that does not work.
To the Reverend Al Sharpton.
Chauvin is in the courtroom, but America's on trial.
To news anchor Lindsay Davis.
On its face, Derek Chauvin is on trial for sure. But for many Americans, this nation is on trial. Our criminal justice system is on trial. And for many, especially Black people, this is about Black and white. This is about justice for people who aren't specifically involved in this case. The countless Black people who have been killed by police in this country with very little repercussions.
This trial is clearly about much more than one man's guilt or innocence. The witness testimony was emotional as they watched newly released police body cam video and surveillance video. And as one by one, witnesses recounted seeing that knee on that neck on that day. The trauma and guilt still there almost a year later.
It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more.
Officer Chauvin seemed very comfortable with the majority of his weight balanced on top of Mr. Floyd's neck.
You could see that he was going through tremendous pain, and you can see it in his face from the grunting.
He was vocalizing it to the officer. He said, "My stomach hurt, I can't breathe, my head hurts, I want my mom."
Witness after witness spoke inside the courthouse as protesters gathered outside. ABC's Kenneth Moten was there. We asked him what it felt like.
Exhausted is the first word that comes to mind because these supporters of George Floyd and his family have been in these streets demonstrating day in, day out, during jury selection, and also now during this trial. In fact, right now, there's a demonstration. Many of them have been happening on the other side of this courthouse. And for many, this felt like ground zero. It felt like the epicenter of the racial reckoning.
And then the jury made its decision. The verdict was quick and decisive. Almost a year after we all watched George Floyd die beneath the knee of police officer Derek Chauvin, a jury in Minneapolis convicted him on all counts. The city and the country erupting in cheers, tears, and applause. Minnesota reporter Janelle Klein has been covering the trial for ABC News and has been giving us updates the past couple of weeks. She spoke with firefighter Chris Edmond after finding out the verdict.
Tell me a little bit about your feelings today as the verdict came down.
I mean, I was shocked, I was happy, and I just pray today is just a new day where I'm all about law enforcement. I work with the police officers. I know there's a lot of good police officers, but hopefully the next time a police officer is going to make a critical decision, they think about this case. It just crosses their mind, and they just do the right thing and make a different choice. I feel bad for Chauvin because he's a victim of the Minneapolis Police Department. He's been on this force for 19 years. That wasn't the first time he put his knee on someone's neck, but no one died. No one recorded it. It wasn't broad daylight. And all of his sergeants, all of his lieutenants, wiped all that stuff under the rug. You know, they had the thin blue wall, and it got blown up. So now it's time that they create policies where if protocol and policies are not enforced, everybody up the chain gets in trouble. And you force people to protect their own butt to throw somebody else under the bus if they act outside of policy.
ABC's Mark Remillard has also been in Minneapolis. He's got more on what's ahead for the city, its police department, and the American justice system.
Sherry, the guilty verdicts in the trial of Derek Chauvin for many were a long time coming.
We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty.
When word of that verdict came down, I was outside the courthouse and witnessed the crowd that had gathered there erupt in cheers.
You see the crowd cheering right now. Derek Chauvin, guilty. Guilty, second-degree murder.
It became a celebration, a release of tension, but as the hours moved on, there was a shift. The jubilation over the verdict was still there, but the recognition that this verdict is not an end, but a beginning, became more evident.
Guilty!
As crowds gathered
guilty!
Outside the courthouse, awaiting word of what the verdict would be, in the center was a man with a megaphone, leading the people in chants and rally cries for a guilty verdict. I recall hearing him say to the crowd, "In the next 10 minutes, you're about to witness history." And it feels that way. It feels historic. George Floyd's brother, Philonis Floyd, told ABC News the day after the verdict that his brother's life and death matter.
He didn't die in vain. And also, he helped change the world. He made people realize that people's lives matter.
But the country has been down this road before. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison talked after the verdict about how many times in the last several decades there have been incidents that sparked calls for change.
This verdict reminds us how hard it is to make enduring change. We have seen Rodney King, Abner Louima, Oscar Grant, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland, Philando Castile, Laquan McDonald.
So I think back to the man with the megaphone telling the crowd, "You're about to witness history." Yes, it's true, they did. But was it historic simply because it was rare? Chauvin's conviction is one of just a handful of times in the last 15 years or so that a police officer was convicted of murdering someone in the line of duty. Or is it historic because it prompted the broader societal change in policing and to relations between police and minorities that those outside the courthouse hope it will? For that, only time will tell. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Mark Remillard, ABC News, Minneapolis.
With all the protests and news coverage over the past year, what does this moment mean for Americans, especially Black Americans? We talked about that this week with ABC News Nightline anchor Byron Pitts, who also traveled to Minneapolis for the verdict.
The air was heavy, right? People, there was great anticipation. Certainly the presence of 2,000 National Guardsmen indicated the concern that everybody had, but few were willing to talk about. What happens if the verdict goes in the direction that people hoped it wouldn't go in? A number of businesses in downtown Minneapolis were boarded up. A good crowd was gathered at what's now known as George Floyd Square, the corner of 38th in Chicago and the south side of Minneapolis. And then there is this just eruption of joy, I think, is the word I'll use. Not joy in a sense of victory, but joy in the sense that for a number of people, they felt like the justice system worked for them. One of the things that struck me most was there have been rare moments in American history where Black America and white America look at the exact same thing and see it in the exact same way. That in this jury, this diverse American jury, 6 whites, 4 blacks, and 2 people who identified themselves as multiracial, saw the same videotape, heard the same witnesses, looked at the same evidence, and apparently fairly quickly drew the same conclusion. That's a rare moment in our nation's history, particularly in the space of the racial divide that has been a part of American history since the first slaves arrived in Jamestown generations ago.
Where do you think that we stand as a country when it comes to policing in the U.S., and especially when it comes to Black Americans and specifically Black men?
That's the million-dollar question. Will it get better? I would think most good and decent Americans would hope it gets better. Clearly, there's documentation that it's not been good for generations in our country. There have been lots of comparisons of George Floyd, his case, how he galvanized the nation, to what the death and images of Emmett Till did in 1955. The Voting Rights Act didn't pass until 1965. It took 10 long years, a lot of bad things that happened after Emmett Till's death, for there to be legislative change. So is America better in that regard than it was in 1955? Almost certainly. Has America changed dramatically since George Floyd was killed in 2020? Not as best I can tell. So yeah, I think it was Dr. King who said in 1968, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. I think most of us believe that, hope that, but when I hear that quotation for Dr. King, I'm reminded of the word long. Justice sometimes takes a very long time.
ABC's Byron Pitts, thanks so much for all your work this week, and we really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
Next Friday, January 7th, a judge in Brunswick, Georgia, will hand down sentences to the father and son, Gregory and Travis McMichael, as well as their friend, William Roddy Bryan. All were convicted in the killing of 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery last year. Just before the verdict, we discussed the case and whether America has changed with our Steve Osunsami, who'd been covering the trial and has covered many others just like it for the past two decades.
The thing that struck me, and it strikes me about the Rittenhouse trial as well, is this presumption that we seem to have in America, that when a white man tells you, a Black man, to stop, that the expectation is that you should stop. You know, Travis McMichael said over and over and over, you know, I just wanted to ask him a few questions. We just wanted to, you know, figure out what was going on, you know, as he has standing with a gun, pointing a gun at this man. And now that, you know, when, you know, and we've heard the same argument in this trial and in the other trial, he was running at me. He was going to hurt me. He was going to grab my gun. I had to stand my ground with my gun because I didn't want him to take it from me and shoot me with my own gun. That becomes the justification for this killing. That stands out to me. I've heard, you know, there's just so many cases where, you know, that argument is used. And this is getting a little personal, but I have a very modern family. And, you know, you're on Zoom, so you can see this, and this is radio, but this is my daughter.
The glare is, oh, she's beautiful.
Yeah, this is my daughter. And
she's also white.
She is white, right. And we have a, like I said, we're a very multiracial family, gay, all that stuff. I know that if she were the one who refused to stop to Travis Michael, never said a word to him, if she were the one who grabbed his gun because he, you know, who tried to push her way away from him, I know that none of us would be here right now if it were her. Because there wouldn't have been a presumption that he was right for stopping her and that she should have stopped because he told her to. There is a certain set of presumptions that I see in this trial that really hit me, in that there were other people, we heard testimony, there were other people who were at that same construction site who did not raise the level of suspicions that this young Black man did.
You brought up the Kyle Rittenhouse case.
Yeah.
And the Kyle Rittenhouse case happened in the midst of a protest against a police shooting of a Black man who was unarmed in Kenosha, Wisconsin. This case is different, but do you feel a difference now than you did in the James Byrd case 21 years ago, 22 years ago?
There is a difference. The conversation that's happening in this country over the issue of race is a lot louder than it was then. The diversity of the media that is sharing these stories is different now than it was then. When I first started, we only had, I want to say, four Black correspondents on the air four Black television correspondents on the air at the time. Today, at least twice that, if not three times as many, and behind the camera and in government. So yeah, things are different, but that's also what makes it so surprising that we're still having these same conversations and still dealing with these same issues.
ABC Steve Osunsami covering the trial in Brunswick, Georgia, of three white men accused of shooting and killing 25-year-old Black unarmed jogger Ahmaud Arbery. Thank you, Steve.
Yes, it was good to talk with you.
A week before the three men were found guilty on all counts, Kyle Rittenhouse, the young man who was shot and killed two protesters following a police-involved shooting in Kenosha, Wisconsin, was acquitted on all counts.
This is Jim Ryan in Kenosha. The city has been on edge since the start of the trial, but now people who live here hope that the reaction to the jury's verdict is a peaceful one.
If the police chief continues with what he's doing, with trying to get this community together, I think there's a possibility. There's hope. There's always hope.
Longtime resident Lynn Beretta. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has issued a statement urging peace in the wake of the verdict. Jim Ryan, ABC News, Kenosha, Wisconsin.
This year, ABC News, with the help of our ABC television affiliates nationwide, investigated whether police departments really reflect the communities in which they serve. The project was spearheaded by our chief law and justice correspondent, Pierre Thomas. Let's talk about Minneapolis. Obviously, that's where the George Floyd killing happened and Derek Chauvin. Minneapolis is one of those cities that a lot of people who are not in Minneapolis look at and think it's a white metropolitan area, but it's not. It's a lot more diverse than that. And the police departments in those Minneapolis and the surrounding areas don't really reflect that.
The community is much more diverse than people might think. And what we found is that that can have an impact on arrest rates as well. In Minneapolis, the number of Black people arrested compared to their white counterparts was much, much higher.
Now, when it comes to actually recruiting police officers, what a lot of these police departments say, including the San Antonio Police Department, who told ABC News, look, this isn't just doesn't just happen. You have to start years in advance to recruit these people, have everybody committed and everybody on down. Is that what you're hearing from a lot of these areas, that this kind of thing takes a lot of time? It doesn't happen overnight.
Police departments are making this more and more of a priority. The question is, how effective are they at reaching out to ethnic groups? Some Black law enforcement professionals say that the effort has been sporadic and that not as directed, not as focused on the places where they could find minority candidates, including the church. Again, lots of work needs to be done in many of these communities, according to the data that we looked at. We talked to one officer, African-American officer, who said he joined the force, sought a career as a police officer, in fact, because he was trying to bridge those gaps. And here was a person who was skeptical of police, saying that he had been harassed. And his point was that in some cases, it's just unsaid. If a person of color encounters a officer who is a person of color, that there might be more rapport. Again, it's a natural thing in some ways. Some of this has to do with training, quite frankly. But as we can see in this country, and what we've learned about how African Americans feel about the police, that in many cases they do not believe that they're treated the same as their white counterparts. One of the things we found is that there apparently is some evidence that when police departments are more diverse, it does affect perhaps the rate of arrest. We did a study with our own stations published last year, and we found in metro areas where police officers were 90% white, Black people were five times more likely to be arrested than their white counterparts. But in metro areas where people of color made up at least half of the police officers, the rate of Black arrests was cut by more than half. Now, you can't assign all that to high crime patterns or whatever. That's an issue that definitely needs more study.
ABC's Pierre Thomas, our chief law and justice correspondent, on police officers and whether they actually mirror the communities in which they serve. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Gloucester City, New Jersey, sits right across the Delaware River from Philadelphia. The most recent census data shows it's about 80% white, 10% Latino, and 10% Black and other minorities. It's also right next to Camden, New Jersey, which is 77% non-white. Gloucester City was founded 398 years ago, and this week welcomed its very first Black police officer. Coming up, an injustice that lasted five decades. Exoneration for the men who spent years in prison for killing Malcolm X, which they didn't do. On Perspective, after this.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
From ABC News, this is a special edition of Perspective 2021, America's Racial Reckoning, the second year. Coming up, the important role that sports has played in pushing for social change. But first, Malcolm X was one of the most prominent figures of the civil rights movement. He had broken away from the Nation of Islam and was on the verge of starting his own organization when he was assassinated in New York in 1965. More than five decades later, the two men convicted of aiding the assassin had their convictions thrown out. Their lawyers had insisted all along their convictions had been in error. And ABC's Aaron Katursky says in 2021, prosecutors finally admitted it. Here's the story.
They don't attack me because I'm a Muslim. They attack me because I'm black. They attack all of us for the same reason. All of us catch hell from the same enemy.
Malcolm X, celebrated and reviled as a black nationalist leader, had broken with the Nation of Islam by February 21, 1965, and was about to speak to a gathering of a new organization he founded at the Audubon Ballroom in Washington Heights.
I am at the Audubon Ballroom. Pandemonium is the only word that I can use to describe the scene here.
Gene Simpson, on a day off from his job as a reporter for WMCA Radio, attended the speech.
I heard a rumbling behind me, and I'm sure everyone else did too, and I turned around in my seat to see what it was. And then we saw, like, I saw two guys standing up. And the next thing, my next impression, it all happened very rapidly, as you can understand, is of the gunshots.
Three men were convicted of the assassination.
Calling number one on the tap A calendar, indictment number 871 of 1965.
A judge in Manhattan this week said two of those convictions were in error.
The court finds that an earnest reinvestigation has uncovered significant evidence.
The new evidence included a witness who backed up the alibi of Muhammad Aziz. Now 83, he and Khalil Islam, who died in 2009, spent 20 years in prison for a murder they did not commit.
I apologize for what were serious, unacceptable violations of law and the public trust. I apologize on behalf of our nation's law enforcement for this decades-long injustice.
Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance re-examined the case over the last 2 years and determined Aziz and Islam did not receive a fair trial because evidence that could have helped prove their innocence had been withheld and certain information had been suppressed.
Most critically, we have obtained dozens and dozens of reports from the FBI and the NYPD's Bureau of Special Services and Investigations. These records include FBI reports of witnesses who failed to identify Mr. Islam and who implicated other subjects and suspects. And significantly, we now have reports revealing that on orders from Director J. Edgar Hoover himself, the FBI ordered multiple witnesses not to tell police or prosecutors that they were, in fact, FBI informants.
There's no doubt at all that this was the right decision for the DA to make at this point in time, but it's just as clear that this should have happened a long time ago.
David Shanus is Aziza's attorney.
The experience of being prosecuted and accused of committing such a horrific crime, knowing the entire time that you're innocent, can only be described as horrible, terrifying. To then be convicted, which he never expected he would be because he knew he was innocent, was surreal. It was horrific.
Shanus and Barry Scheck at the Innocence Project championed the case and convinced the DA to review and ultimately rewrite the history of the murder of Malcolm X.
It changed the history of this country that he was assassinated. And if it had been corrected in the sense that we would have known exactly who did it and why, which the FBI and the NYPD, if they had disclosed this information, could have clarified for the public, right? That would have changed the course of history.
More than a dozen FBI and NYPD reports were never disclosed to the defense, including eyewitness descriptions of the gunman that did not match either Islam or Aziz.
The event that brought us to court today should never have occurred. Those events were and are the result of a process that was corrupt to its core, one that was all too familiar to black people in 2021.
Aziz, in a gray tunic and white mask, addressed the court on the day of his exoneration.
I'm an 83-year-old man who was victimized by the criminal justice system. I do not know how many more years of creative activity I have. However, I hope the same system that was responsible for this travesty of justice also takes responsibility for the immeasurable harm caused to me during the last 55 or 56 years. Thank you, Your Honor.
Moments later, the judge made it official.
This court's mandate requires that the judgments of conviction be vacated and that the indictment against Mr. Aziz and Mr. Islam be dismissed. The joint motion is hereby granted. And the record...
As applause broke out in the courtroom, Aziz appeared to nod gently and accept a congratulatory pat on the shoulder from his lawyer. He left court innocent in the eyes of the law. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Aaron Katursky, ABC News, New York.
In February, ABC News broke the story that clinicians feared the NFL's concussion settlement program was discriminating against black players by using the practice called race norming. It assumed that the average black player started out at a lower cognitive function than the average white player at the outset of their careers, meaning black players needed to show a larger decline than their white counterparts to qualify for compensation. When a judge sent the league and lawyers representing former players to the negotiating table, attorney Christopher Seeger, who represented former players during the NFL's concussion settlement negotiations, said his firm had investigated the issues and found no evidence of racial bias. Then, in June, he reversed course. I was wrong. That's what the negotiator in the billion-dollar NFL concussion lawsuit is saying about the way decisions have been made regarding who should be compensated and who shouldn't. Following an ABC News investigation, Christopher Seeger, who represents former players, is speaking out amid criticism of his response to allegations of racial bias in the program. He has also apologized to black former players who have claimed the league's protocols skewed payouts along racial lines. ESPN's Ryan Smith broke the story.
The NFL is pledging to make sure race no longer plays a part in the landmark 2013 NFL concussion settlement program, which has so far paid eligible former players suffering from the effects of head injuries hundreds of millions of dollars.
Football doesn't give you an expiration date. You just expire.
But players like former Steelers defensive end Kevin Henry say they didn't qualify because of the color of their skin. Despite battling memory loss, headaches, and depression, symptoms Henry suspects are long-term effects of head injuries he sustained on the field, his claims were denied.
I just want to be looked at the same way as a white guy.
At the center of the firestorm, a controversial practice known as race norming. In medicine, it's supposed to help doctors make better diagnoses by using race to make assumptions about a patient's background. Critics say using it to determine level of brain injury is discriminatory because it assumes black players start at a lower cognitive level than white ones, making it harder for black players to prove enough damage to qualify for payouts.
How did you react when you learned that there was a different standard being used for black players to get benefits as compared to white players?
I felt so betrayed, and I still feel that way.
Though the NFL says there is no merit to any claim of discrimination, an NFL spokesperson now tells ABC News they are committed to eliminating race-based norms in the program, saying the league will review claims that were previously rejected.
Hey, how are you, Ryan?
Attorney Chris Seeger is representing the former players. He's the same man who negotiated the landmark settlement 8 years ago. It was in the details of the settlement that a recommendation of race norming in evaluating former players was included. But he's now under fire from a growing number of his own clients who feel he let them down in the original negotiations and in his more recent response to criticism of the program.
I'm really sorry that anybody, any client of mine in this program has been made to feel that way. That was a big mistake. It was a failure of the system.
In an exclusive interview with ABC News, Seeger is making a shocking admission.
I was wrong. I didn't have a full appreciation of the scope of the problem. I'm on top of this, and I'm going to eliminate race norming from the settlement. And if that results in me having to score every single claim again, especially where race norming was applied, I will fight to have that done.
So for former black players who have felt discriminated against, what argument do you make to them as to why you are the best person to represent them in this process?
I'm fully cognizant of this country's history, of what has happened to black people in this country. I know this very well. I can't say I'm walking in somebody else's shoes, but I'm not oblivious to it. This has to get fixed. This is deeper than just the NFL concussion settlement.
So where do we go from here? Seeger says he's reevaluating every single case where race may have factored into a denial. But both sides have to come to an agreement, while thousands of families and millions of dollars hang in the balance. Now, since that story aired, the two sides reached an agreement that will end racial norming. The deal will allow for a reevaluation of past claims and could pay out hundreds of millions of dollars to former players and their families. This year, ABC News embarked on an ambitious project called Soul of a Nation. It was the first network news magazine examining the black experience as told by black Americans. The series aired over the summer and began with a piece on the role that race and sports play in social justice. The show features interviews with John Carlos, Michael Thomas, Renee Montgomery, and others, and the lead segment was hosted by ESPN's Michael Wilbon.
Leading up to the 1968 Olympic Games, the country was at a flashpoint of the civil rights movement.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis tonight.
6 months after the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Olympians John Carlos and Tommy Smith stood atop the world's biggest stage, calling attention to the plight of black America.
Dr. King was going to come out and support the Olympic boycott. But I asked Dr. King, why would you get involved in the Olympic movement? And he said to me, he said, imagine you get in a rowboat and you row it to the center of this enormous lake. And then you take a rock and throw a rock overboard. It creates waves. He said, that rock is the Olympic movement. But the greatest thing is that you have the attention of the planet. You didn't have to kill or maim or hurt anyone to make that statement.
When you got back from Mexico City, what was it like?
Chaos, mayhem, hatred.
Did you have any idea the intensity of the backlash of the hatred?
The repercussion would be death.
Cops are getting paid leave for killing people.
After the shootings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick was vilified for taking a knee during the national anthem. Some called him a distraction to his team, even un-American. Have you talked to Colin Kaepernick?
I talked to Colin and let him know that I thought that he was a hero of mine. When you jump out into the pool of humanitarianism, it's a lonely job. The times are different, but collectively, all the responses to each of those statements were the same in a negative sense.
With very little public support from fans and the league, that season went on to be Kaepernick's last. Michael Thomas is one of the few players that season who took a knee with Kaepernick in solidarity.
Tell me about what the reaction was maybe in your family.
You know, I had the conversation with my parents, like, look, I'm thinking about making a decision to take a knee. It was like, I don't want you to be punished for speaking out.
What were locker rooms like that you were in?
There were definitely guys who, like, black teammates, that's the part that hurt, that were telling us, like, nah, man, y'all stupid. Like, we ain't trying to mess up our money. It was definitely a time in the NFL where you could probably lose your job.
And Michael Wilbon joins us now to talk more about it. Michael, one of the first people that you interviewed was John Carlos. He's the sprinter who, after winning the bronze medal in the 1968 Olympics, raised his fist in a Black Power salute in defiance on that Olympic podium and was suspended from the team for it, along with Tommy Smith, who had won gold and also raised his fist in the air with that black glove on it during the medal ceremony. What does John Carlos have to say about what's happening now?
One of the things I was most curious about was how it is so trendy to do it now. It's trendy to protest. It's trendy to talk about social justice. It wasn't for him. He doesn't talk about what he lost very much. And I'm sure he's gotten tired of talking about it over the last 50 years, but he seems like he's very welcome to have people now with the lens of history to help, to view this whole thing and be ready to get involved. Though no one sacrifices like he and Tommy did. You know, he has a complete 360 degree sense of what it takes to protest then, now, what people think of him then, now, to the point where he has the closed fisted glove on his American flag mask. I found that to be very telling.
What do you think it is that has made it finally move something now? I mean, people, you talk about a lot in that segment about Colin Kaepernick, and that was sort of kind of the start of something. But, you know, was that something that started the conversation that needed to be had?
That's a great question. It restarted it. But why so many now? I mean, they make enough money now that there is no sacrifice like John Carlos' sacrifice. And by the way, the WNBA women do have a lot more at stake because they're not making the kind of dollars that could lead to a firing and then just saying, fine, I'll just run off into the sunset.
Totally.
You know, it's my, you know, 22,000 square foot mansion. So their sacrifice is real in a tangible financial way. But male athletes now at that level, black male athletes, they have means and they know it that can allow, thankfully, I'm not resentful of it. I'm glad they have it. So that if there were repercussions, if there are, the four gentlemen who came up on stage at the ESPYs, LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony, Chris Paul, and Dwayne Wade, they don't have to fear those consequences. There are consequences, but they don't have to fear them. And so I think now it's simply, I hate to use the word easier, but it is financially less punitive. How about we say it that way? For all of them to say, to hell with this, I'm speaking up. The penalties for this in the 1960s and 1970s were just so much greater.
ESPN's Michael Wilbon. You can watch all the episodes of Soul of a Nation from ABC News on Hulu. This has been a special edition of Perspective, America's Racial Reckoning, the second year. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. The show was produced by Leighton Schneider. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.